Welcome to the Andrew D'Angelo podcast.
Constant Constance. Each week, Andrew, renowned jazz saxophonist and brain cancer survivor, invites us to look at the many worlds of his guests with conversations that cover all the arts, human resilience, a little bit of politics, and a lot of humour.
You can't fail to have a fantastic time.
Hey everyone, and welcome. Today we have the fabulous, and I actually was going to say delightful, saxophonist, singer, songwriter, composer, and also she has a PhD in cognitive science from Northwestern. So fancy. Welcome to the show, Caroline Davis. Thank you for coming today. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Awesome. Did you have your run today? Did you go for a jog?
Yes, it was so amazing. The weather was just
sublime, right?
You had as good a time too, right?
I'm like, da, 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 da. Yeah, even so, like, I went for a victory lap at the end because it's so nice out. I was like, you know what? I think I'm going to walk for a little bit. Then I'm going to go for an extra run because it's so nice out. And then
I did that too. I did my distance and then I was like, you know what? I'm going to run an extra mile today. That's going to happen.
I don't know if I ran an extra mile, but I definitely was like, I'm going to do more because it's too nice and I want to be outside. And as I was getting prepared for your interview and speaking with different people, either via social media or actually on the phone, a lot of people were really curious, like, what is cognitive science? I mean, you have a PhD, you have your Dr. Caroline Davis. What does it mean to you? I mean, I grabbed something off the internet. Anybody can do that. Cognitive science is the interdisciplinary scientific study of the mind and its processes. I mean, that couldn't be more vague, right?
It's kind of true though, I would say.
Right. I know, but I'm like, does that mean? I don't want to sound stupid to people, but I'm like, that could mean anything.
Yeah. I mean, so I guess it helps to have a little background, but when I was getting my undergraduate degree, I went to a really small school in Texas called the University of Texas at Arlington, which is under the umbrella of the UT schools. And it's in between Dallas and Fort Worth. And so I went there and I entered that school as a pre-med major. And I even went to this whole like pre-med program, summer camp for kids, nerdy kids.
Wow.
At like Brown University. And we all were there for a week and we all spent days as doctors. Like, what would your day be like if you were a doctor? And so we would go around and see patients. And then we would see, here's a patient who we're doing surgery on, except for we actually were lucky enough to be around a cadaver that we were kind of working with at the time. And I just like love that stuff so much. I really wanted to be a surgeon when I was little.
Wow. So it's like real life, that game operation. I mean, wow. And I mean, one of the things that was cool when you and I talked the other day on the phone, and that's when I found out you had that degree, and then you're talking to a guy, that's why I sent you that photo. I'm like, you know, I mean I'm not joking, right? Like it was like over half of my head was cut open and they just like removed that part of my brain, and here I am talking to a cognitive scientist. I mean, it's like amazing. I was like all ready to talk about your music, and we'll get there, but I just absolutely. It's fascinating to me. Like, here's the patient. I'm the cadaver, right? And you're the pretend doctor because you didn't actually end up getting a medical degree, right?
No, yeah. But you're not a cadaver because you're alive.
I know.
Miracle.
Miracle man.
It really is. Yeah, it's a miracle. I went into that sort of program and then I realized quickly that I wouldn't be able to keep practicing and doing the music thing at the same level. So I changed to cognitive psychology, and the people who were influential at that time. There was a professor there named Ira Bernstein, who just was like, so
great into, name. It's a yeah, great name.
So into music. And he was like, do you know about music cognition? I'm going to teach you all about this. And he made me read this book. I mean, it make me, but he gave me this book, Hermann von Helmholtz, On the Sensations of Tone. And that was sort of my introduction to a person who did work with cadavers, but went inside and looked at the ear, the structure of the ear. And so I got super into it. And then I was finishing and I'm like, oh, I really want to do, you know, music cognition and cognitive science. Where should I go? So I applied to all these places and Northwestern offered me that PhD program, which really is an interdisciplinary degree between music. For me, it was between music, cognitive science, and ethnomusicology. So my work sort of centered around those three topics.
It's fascinating to think that you spent all that time, you know, studying. And, you know, what the reason I chose my gold shirt is when I had brain cancer, they had done studies on folks from India after they had passed away, and their brains were actually yellow from turmeric, they assumed, or curry, curcumin. Right. And I believe this study. Right. I mean, I had brain cancer at the time and they're like, it seemed so that these cadavers weren't fresh, but they're somehow their brain, because it was like encased in or soaked, I guess, with turmeric, that they started to think that it had a huge effect on the brain. So I started taking I don't know why it's called curcumin or turmeric. I'm not sure the difference there.
But, well, I think that's just French, curcumin. I think it's just French for turmeric. Maybe.
Okay. All right, I'm sure somebody will correct us or correct me. But so I was just started taking tons and tons, shitloads basically, of turmeric.
Yeah.
And I have no idea if it helped. I've never had any proof, but I just thought, I don't know. It's kind of interesting. Don't you think? Or
yeah, absolutely. Did you, so the fresh one where like where your hands turning yellow and everything.
At first that gets a little annoying. Right. So then, and then I was also after the brain surgeries, I was taking, I don't know, like, and I'm not exaggerating, 48, 50 different vitamins and supplements and herbs a day. And so, you know, at a certain point, I just want to start swallowing pills. I wasn't like, I can't do the chew on the cinnamon or the turmeric root, you know, or like the powder. I was trying to cook with it, but this is like, I'll just take a pill. But so in after your studies and what spawned this interview, this conversation, was I saw one of your, what do you call them? Oscillations. And on, I believe it was Instagram or Twitter, it doesn't really matter, one of the social media platforms. And you were doing, I think 52 weeks was your initial plan, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what our auditory systems are nonlinear. So we need fun ways to look at how the internal dynamics of the brain could or could not be related to the sound itself. For example, oscillators in the brain are capable of oscillations. That seems to be explaining itself. That confuses me a little bit. And it's your own words, I think. So did your cognitive science or your psychology work filter or float into your musical, you know, into your saxophone playing or your other music on some level? Or
yeah, so I think in that post that you were reading, I'm saying there, for example, oscillators in the brain are capable of locking in with what the music is doing. It continues on that post. It's like a weird, you know how Twitter is. I think you're reading off of Twitter, right?
Yeah.
But what I'm saying right there is that, for example, oscillators in the brain are capable. You can have these, well, first of all, let me back up a little bit. For those people, you know, for anyone who maybe doesn't know, but we have, you know, billions of neurons in our brains. And what's happening is in our science world, we don't have the technology to measure what one neuron is doing at a given moment in time.
Cause it's
so tiny.
Wow.
We can do that with rat brains and monkey brains and brains that we can sort of get into without feeling bad about harming, although I would feel pretty bad about harming, right. But that's the lab science, you know. But anyway, what we our science is predicting the action of many different neurons firing at the same time. And so those are what we call oscillations. That's the rhythmic principle that's happening in the brain. These neurons, these groups of neurons that are connected together via a network and via their axons and via the structure of the neuron in the brain. Each neuron has a structure and how they're connected together via these dendrites, which are these like filamental, they look like basically, if actually it's really fascinating to look at the pictures at a zoomed in viewpoint, because they look like trees. They look literally like a tree, you know, like, and so they're all connected to each other, you know?
This is the point where I go, huh? I'm just kidding. Dendrites?
No, you get that.
Dendrites?
Like, I mean, it's just a word, but you could actually even use the word tree and tree right. branches that connect to each other. And each tree branch connects, you know, these little miniature micro, really they're micro nano on the scale of nano and micro millimeters or even smaller. They're connecting to each little tiny itty bitty neuron, and those neurons form networks. And you can totally understand. It's just like a social scene where you're like, okay, you're connected to so-and-so and you're connected to this person. Right. And it's a big network, you know? And so all of those neurons are firing together and they create this rhythm. And that's what an oscillation is. And the point I guess I'm trying to make with this whole series is that those rhythms are not periodic, meaning they don't come back at the same time, at the same place. And it's just like a heartbeat. The heartbeat isn't periodic. It changes over time. There's a heart rate variability. And it depends on so many other things that are going on with your organs and your body. But we think of things as very stable in our world and very normal.
Or static. Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But it's not the case. It's not the case. So what I'm saying in this last post is that actually are the rhythms that are happening in our brains, these responses to things out in the world, it's capable for those things to lock in with the music that's outside. But it's also capable that these rhythms and these neurons are locking in to something that's not in the music, or and that's something that we feel inside, you know? So what I'm saying in that post is that there's both sides of the coin of like, okay, yeah, the music does influence what we hear, but we also have internal things that are happening inside of our bodies and our brains that are predicting things that aren't happening in the music. Does that make sense?
It does. And that was something that came up that I wanted to ask you about. But yeah. Two things. Remind me if I don't get back to that, because I want to ask you about that. Do you know J.D. Allen, the tenor saxophonist?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I had him on the show, and we were talking. He's really into trees and their root systems, and they've understood that these root systems communicate with each other. I think it was there's something on NPR or PBS or something like that. Have you heard about this?
Maybe a little bit. And it's so fascinating. Yeah,
it is. And JD's really into it, and as am I. So I'm curious, when you're talking about these branches, okay, and are you sure that's what it is? Is it not root systems, or is there no difference? Like, which analogy, or does it really matter?
Well, I would say that there really are parts of branches that are connecting to, and I see that in a lot of different sort of elementary neuroscience books where people are trying to explain the structure of a neuron. They compare those that what I'm talking about is the dendrite, and they compare dendrites to trees. And so, yeah, I guess I would say that they're like branches that connect to individual neurons. They're all connecting via this structure of branches, because branches can, like, it's not just one branch. There's a branch, you know, there's not just one element to a branch. There's like multiple things that split off from a branch.
Right.
You know?
Of course. Sure.
And so that's how I would understand it in my brain. And I feel like roots are similar, but they're connected to a foundation. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess you could use both metaphors, you know?
Yeah, I'm just curious, because I obviously I have a small fascination with the brain because of my own situation. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about that, there are things happening inside of our brain when music, we're listening to music that aren't being actually heard in the music. I mean, I think in our phone conversation, you said it's like if somebody took out the first beat of a song, you know, every bar or every chorus, somehow the brain would still insert that first beat. Is that fair? Is that a fair?
Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's cool. My friend, who's a neuroscientist, who knows much more about this than me, because I'm not a neuroscientist, but his name is Ed Large. And in his work,
another great name.
Yeah. It's really.
Ira Bernstein and Ed Large live at Carnegie Hall, right?
That's so right. Yeah. Ed's work is really important to me because he's been showing that. He'll play these complex, he's actually played a lot of polyrhythms for people in his lab. And he'll also do this thing where he'll ask people to tap spontaneously and see sort of what happens, which is really fun to read those papers. And what he's finding is even in complex rhythms, we're kind of inserting a downbeat. We're inserting things that make sense in the music. If you don't hear a downbeat, the brain will make up the downbeat there. And it's the same for, the overtone series. So if we don't hear a fundamental, we'll put it in there. And that phenomenon is called the missing fundamental. And Diana Deutsch found that in the 70s and 80s. Right. She found that if you play signals for people and they're full of overtones, but there's no fundamental frequency, they'll still hear the fundamental frequency. It's amazing. It's like a visual illusion where you're seeing the rabbit in the, the vase in the face. That visual illusion, it's you either see the vase or the face.
Oh yeah, right. There's a bunch of those now because of the internet. There's a bunch of those.
Yeah, but you can't see them at the same time. It's a similar process.
I don't know if it's worth it to get in depth in that, but how did she measure that? How does one measure, that particular, you're hearing fundamentals that aren't being presented to you, and you use the word signal. I don't really, by signal, what do you mean? Do you mean a note or a pitch?
Whatever's being played for your ear.
So is that the same? I also have a neuroscientist friend, Darren Stevens, who I met on Facebook through a friend of mine who I've never met in person, and was just completely. I mean, he was saying, come on, you have to have some physical, limitations after everything you did to your brain. I was like, no. And he didn't believe me. So he called me. We talked for 3 hours. I'd like to have him on the show, but he's quite shy. But he was like, come on, there's got to be something. I said, dude, talk to me for as long as you want. I don't think I have. I mean, I think that maybe I stutter sometimes, but, people do that. Without brain, but I totally got off track there, but it's interesting to me that, if a non-musician is listening to a song, and in that song, no matter what it is, a pop song, a jazz song, I don't care. If the first beat of the measure or the bar or of the chorus, as I said, gets dropped or is silent, the brain, you're saying the brain, that person, even if they're not a musician, somehow is compensating for that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And that's a lot of why when we hear those moments in the music, they excite us because they're unexpected and we're having a reaction because our systems want this, because we're so used to hearing a downbeat in the music of our culture. And if it's gone, then we're so excited and we're reacting with a pleasure response. And that's what happens a lot of the time when people are listening to music.
It makes you wonder about those people that we think who overplay and play really complicated, whatever. I've been watching this podcast called That Chapter, and this guy Mike O has all these moments where it just goes to black and there's no music, he's not talking, it just goes to black for a few seconds. It's so powerful, and it's throughout his show, it just goes, and then he gets back on and it's like, whoa. I was like, dude, those moments where it's silent and it's just you fade to black are absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's got millions of followers, of course, right? Because his show, well, it's about murders, so that there's that. But
people love to watch about true crime.
Yeah, people exactly.
Love that. I mean, I do too. I love watching true crime.
I'm fascinated by the human condition, and I also have these overlying questions of why did I get to live, right? From like terminal brain cancer, right? Why me? And then why did my friend's nephew just die at 21 from lymphoma? It doesn't make any sense to me. Yeah, it's very sad. It's not, I mean, it's been now a month, but it's like, and I didn't know his nephew, but it's horrible. But why? It doesn't make any sense to me. So when I watch these true crime things, I'm like, God, like what did these people do to get in this situation? I don't know. And here I am, you know, Frankenstein, you know, with fucking 50 staples in my head. And yet here I am 10, whatever years later, you know, I'm fine. It's weird, don't you think? Or am I just being like dramatic?
No, I think it is weird for sure. I mean, also, yeah, I mean, there's a system. I believe in the system of karma. You know, I believe that there's a system of energy and electromagnetic frequency that's in our world and in every body, every object, like the bed or a rock or the sun and water and everything. And all of those electromagnetic frequencies of energy contribute to karma, you know?
And that's one thing I was gonna, since you brought it up, and thank you for bringing it up. You seem, although you're have some science, and I only do that because some people don't like to be associated with certain things, but you definitely seem scientifical. You're obviously very intelligent. You're a doctor. You have a doctorate, but you seem also like a very spiritual person to me. Is that fair?
Yes, very fair.
And so how, if you're willing to answer this question, and I didn't prepare you to ask this question. It was just something I thought about when I was listening to your music yesterday. How do we integrate science and spirituality? Because I have a couple of friends who are very scientific based, and I like to say scientifical because it kind of pisses them off because I don't even know if that's a word. But and when I start going into my, you know, spiritual side, you know, man, you know, my intuition says, man, you know, or whatever, or like, you know, I see Caroline playing this piece of music and I just intuitively like, this would be really fun to have her on the show. And I don't even know her, but I'm just going with my intuition. Like is there a way to describe that? Would you like to take maybe a break and then come back and chat about this and get into your music a little bit? Or what do you think?
We don't have to take a break. I mean, yeah, I can respond to that.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say that science and all the principles behind all the different kinds of science, like physics or quantum physics or cognitive science or neuroscience and psychology, all of those aspects and divisions of science rely on the measurement of energy in some way. Like we measure energy, and that can come in this sense of like, okay, I'm going and I'm measuring like millivolts of a response from an EEG. You know, I'm sure you had a bunch of those done when you were going through your condition, like, or fMRI or what, any kind of measurement. We're measuring, you know, millivolts, or we're measuring cerebral blood flow, or we're measuring, you know, the tracer substance that we have when we have like a PET scan or something. So I feel like if you're ignoring energy, the transmission of energy, which is a very spiritual thing, and you're a scientist, then that goes against every principle that your whole system is based on, you know?
What did you just say? What the fuck are you talking about? No, I'm sorry. I'm just having fun, but I'm also getting very sweaty. Ladies and gentlemen, I have no idea what Caroline just fucking said.
You did though.
I do.
You do.
Yeah. I do. I'm just having fun, but I never had an EEG. I only had MRIs and PETs.
Okay. But you've had that experience, and they're measuring response that your brain is giving to this series of, you're wired up to this thing, or you're lying down and you're passively, and there's magnets, you know, swirling around your head. There's all these magnets and you're in this whole thing. And it's,
I
like,
hate those machines. Yeah. I hate those machines, but to me, they weren't measuring my energy. They were taking photos, real time photos of my brain to see what the hell was going on. Right. so it seemed more physical and scientifical and less, hey, we're measuring your energy. You know, that's not when they're shoving you in the MRI. It's not that we're going to measure your energy now, Mr. D'Angelo, you know,
but that to me is all it is, all energy. That just means energy to me. It's a response of something and you're measuring that response. And so I just say as a general term, all of that stuff is just is energy. And some people can really feel that. And those people we call empaths. And I would say that I'm an empath.
Yes.
And I can feel when someone's having a response to something, I can really feel that. And I have some other friends who are like this. And sometimes it's really overwhelming. Like I went for a run the other day with my partner and there was a person who ran into a bicyclist and they fell over and there was blood, you know, coming out of their leg. Oh, and somebody was like, does anybody have any kind of paper towel? And these police came and no one had a rag. And so someone gave this mask and I almost started crying. I mean, I really almost did. I was really feeling like I was going to cry and I was really feeling her pain. And those kinds of things really affect me. And then we got back to our immediate neighborhood and somebody was like screaming in this on the side of the road to this gentleman in a car. And I also felt his pain. And I'm like, what's going on today? You know, it's really, it can be very overwhelming. And so going outside and interacting with people, especially in New York, can be a very... because you're feeling all of these different energies. One energy point was this person yelling and another energy point was this blood coming out of this person's leg and their heart beating quickly. And I can feel that. And all of those things are energy, but they can also be measured. Like you can measure the millivolts of a heartbeat, but it's also something you can feel.
I tell people as a fellow empath, I'm really glad that you're getting into this. It's like a radio that you can't turn off. So if I go and I'm at a show or something or in a large crowd, I cannot not pick up on everybody's shit, whether it's positive or negative shit. It's as if I can't, it's like, okay, you're mad at your wife. Good. Whatever. Don't take it out on me. Right. Or, you know, all right. You don't know what to buy at the grocery store. Fine. I get it. So I just try to get in those spots and get out of those spots as quickly as possible.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you brought up your partner, Ben, and Caroline is engaged. And you said about a week or a week and a half from today, you're going to be married, right?
Yeah, that's happening.
Very exciting. Let's talk about that project you're doing with your fiance. How does that sound?
Yes, sounds great.
You said the video just came out today, right? As of this or yesterday? I don't remember what you said. Sorry.
Yep, today. Mm-hmm.
And this is more of a singer-songwriter project with your now fiance, Ben. And I don't think you've ever told me Ben's last name, but it doesn't matter.
It's Hoffman.
Ben Hoffman. Mm-hmm. What led you? It's really beautiful music. I listened to the whole thing a few times and it's just, you have a gorgeous voice. What does Ben do? Is he more production or does he play instruments as well? Or what does he do?
Yeah, he plays keyboards and bass. And he also really helped with laying down a lot of the drum tracks. We use the Lindrum, which is something that we kind of took because we love Prince. And so we really wanted to get our hands on a Lindrum, but we don't have one. So we borrowed our friend's Lindrum. And that was really fun. And so my partner was really doing all of that drum tracking, the electronic drum tracking. And then we also have a drummer on the album too, David Frazier.
Oh, David, right. Cool. But again, what for people who have either followed your career or not, what led you in the direction of wanting to do more of a singer-songwriter or maybe is it even pop music? I don't know what to call it. I don't want to insult you, but it's really cool. And I'm attempting to do something similar. I don't know if I'm achieving it as well as you, but I'm definitely done with the fire in the pet store kind of like avant-garde music. I'm just not feeling it anymore myself, but that's just me. But so anyway, what brought you was it Ben that influenced you or was it just something your heart was desiring or?
Yeah, I mean, I've played saxophone for so many years of my life and flute, and I love playing in jazz context and improvised music context and Black American music context and R&B context, all of the contexts I love. And I'm a very open musician in that way. And I've always wanted to write my own songs. And so when I was living in Chicago, I started this band, Maitri, with some other people in that city. And I had my first gigs there singing. And I took some lessons with some gospel singers in Chicago. And that's kind of my influence. And also living in Atlanta for a part of my life, I love like the R&B scene, the gospel scene in Atlanta, and really influenced who I am as a singer. Mary J. Blige and Erykah Badu, all the ladies of En Vogue, SWV, all of those singers have been influential to me. And Kim Burrell, just, I love that style of singing. And I always wanted to write the music, so I started this band and I was writing a few songs and I recorded an album there. And then when I moved to New York, since Ben was moving also, I said, should we just recreate this project here in New York and it'll be our project? And so we started doing that. We wrote a lot of music together and we came out with an album in 2017. And that was that iteration of the band. And now we're even more duo focused and we sort of invited some of collaborators to participate on this album, including David Fraser Jr. and Jen Lingott on bass on a few tracks, and our friend Ivy Asa on production on one song, and Rico Sisney on, he's an MC who lives in California.
It's interesting to me that, I'm not sure that, I mean, the general public understands how much work and energy, and like you just listed so many names and influences, and because so many people are out there doing songs, on their laptop, or I know one of my friends is doing music now on his phone, right? Just himself making these tracks on his phone. And it's amazing to have these collaborations, and all these people involved in your project, and then it really comes across. And as just a little anecdote, do you know Matt Wilson, the drummer?
Absolutely. I love Matt so much.
Matt's amazing. We talk about him a lot in the show, and I hope to have him on at some point. But we got to open for Erica on a tour. Wow. Yeah, we did a couple of shows where we opened for Erica and Erykah Badu. And holy shit, her band is amazing. I mean, to be side stage watching that band play, I mean, there was, I think they said there was something like 15,000 people at the show, right? And so we're side stage just checking out this band, and it's just completely musically incredibly high level stuff going on. They're not playing to backing tracks. I mean, the keyboard players playing the shit out of the Rhodes, right? The drummer's just fucking killing it. And Erica's singing her ass off. Like, we can hear her acoustically and putting on this amazing show. And I don't know. It was great to be in that position, hearing such musicianship that it's cool that you're influenced by her. That was Sweden. I'm pretty sure it was a Sweden gig, and she was really pissed because there was too many white people in the crowd.
That's Sweden for you. I was just in Sweden because, I'm Swedish, so I understand that completely.
Svenska?
Ah, en liten.
Yeah.
Prata.
Ja, snakka lite norsk och dansk och svenska.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Well, I was dating this Norwegian guy. I had to learn a little Norwegian, But
that's so good.
You were just...
Yeah, wow. What, talk about a polymath, a complete polymath, Erykah Badu. She just, in addition to being one of the best singers in the world, she is also just one of the best improvisers in the world. And her sense of style is one of the best in the world. And her sense
amazing.
Of...
Amazing.
And her sense of arrangement, her arranging skills, on the spot arranging, and her sense of energy, production of energy and production of like sensing energy and directing energy and love and acceptance and beauty into the music and into people around her is amazing. I just, a sister of a friend wrote an article about how she was their doula, giving birth to their child. And I'm not sure if you saw that. I think it was in like Vogue magazine. And it was this whole article about how Erykah Badu was this person's doula. And even that part of it, like, is there a, she just, if there, she belongs in like a Greek society where she's just doing all, you know, I imagined her as like a Socrates, but a woman version of that back then, like who's helping everybody in all these ways and intellectual and all of the parts that are so important to our world. She's just that.
I was working when I was still very close to brain cancer. I don't know. I just feel compelled to talk about it a lot since you're, it's kind of like one of your sort of specialties. I was working with this Native American healer who lived in the Midwest, and Erykah also was working with her. Erykah wasn't sick, but she's very into the energetic aspect of life. Yeah. And this Native American woman who doesn't like to be known, so I'm not going to say her name, was having me write these affirmations that, you know, I'm now healed. I'm 100%, you know, healthy. Instead of saying, I don't have brain cancer anymore, she says, no, this is not how we say it. You must say it as if it's already happened, right? That's like her whole thing. And Erykah was really into her. And I love that. And I was curious because the singer-songwriter project with Ben, and which is beautiful, and folks, we'll put the link so you can go find it and please buy it, but you know, I guess stream it if you want. But you said that how did you put it? You're something about it. It's dealing with the intersectionality of race and sex and all that. Would you mind talking about that a little bit or?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so as many people probably know, that word intersectionality was coined by Kimberly Crenshaw. And I think originally she wrote about it and came for it to mean like the way in which sort of many of our social justice issues in the world, you know, like racism and sexism and ableism and ageism and, right. You know, all of those issues are sort of overlapping and intersecting. And she kind of uses the visualization of an intersection, an actual intersection where cars are coming from different directions and things. And so these just social justice issues are creating multiple layers and levels of injustice. And so if, for example, if you're like, there's a wonderful quote by Melba Liston, the trombone player who mm-hmm. played jazz.
Yeah, of course.
About yeah. how, yeah, there's a wonderful quote. She says something like, I'm a woman. Not only am I I'm a woman, but I'm Black and I have two strikes against me or something like this, you know? And this is a perfect example of the ways in which intersectionality are creating injustice or created injustice for Melba Liston to the point where she had to sort of come away from the jazz scene. I don't know if people know about that, but she left the jazz scene to go, I believe, to Jamaica or Haiti, one of the two, to become a teacher, an educator. And Mary Lou Williams did the same thing. Hazel Scott did the same thing. If we think about, you know, some of the most influential female players in jazz, a lot of them left and came back. Some of them came back. But it was just too much because of all of these layers of injustice that were being placed upon their situation. And so anyway, our project, to bring it sort of back there, is, I know we just talked about a lot of things, but like to bring it back, it's just... Yeah, it's kind of our way to comment on that in a way, because yeah, I'm a white woman. And so for me, the influential streams of consciousness and mindfulness that I need to be aware of in my life in order to live and recognize my privilege, to recognize my privilege as a white woman who's straight, and you know, all of these aspects of my life I think about every day, but I think many of us don't. And so we're trying to communicate that to the listener in some way.
That's beautiful. Something came to me as you were speaking. I have a friend, she's a white female who's married to a black man, and they recently moved and they were thinking of moving out of New York, right? Mm-hmm. And then she was talking about airplane, and then it'll fly over my house next, right? She was talking about, well, we'd love to live in, you know, Nashville, or we'd love to live in, you know, Michigan where her parents are, or we'd love to live here or there, but they can't because it's so racist that her black husband would not feel comfortable in these places. And it's just strange. It's not something that, I mean, I've had black and brown boyfriends, but it's just weird to think, oh, we can't live in Nashville because it's so racist there that my husband wouldn't feel comfortable. That's a very strange thought, let alone if you're a black female, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, mm-hmm.
And I challenged a friend of mine the other day. I said, tell me some black female musicians you think I should have on the show. I just asked him. He's a white male. He could not think of one. Wow. Not one.
Yeah.
And that's what I do now when if I'm chatting with a friend or hanging out or whatever, I just say, hey, who do you think should be on the show? But this guy, I was like, tell me a black female. And he's like, I mean, he literally was just hemming and hawing for 5-10 minutes. I don't know.
I could give you a list of names.
Yeah. That's not my point. I know who I'd love to have on the show. My point was, I just wanted to challenge my friend and say, come on, dude. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I can't think of anybody. I was like, great. There's something wrong with that, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why there's something wrong with that. All right, I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. My point is, he says that it's not his fault. He said, well, mm-hmm. I just never was exposed to any black female musicians. And I was like, right. Okay, you're supposed to take over, Caroline, because I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's a
problem. I think it's a big problem.
It's a problem.
And I would love to have Erica Badu on my show. I doubt she would do it, but I'd love to have Erica.
You should ask. I think that would be amazing.
I'm kind of just going for it. And my idea was to have Serena Williams on, because I really love her. And I have a lot of respect for what she's achieved. But it was just interesting. I just kind of sat there on the phone like, uh-huh. Yo. And he was playing some video game, Grand Theft Auto, so I was just kind of hanging out with him. And like, have you thought anybody yet? And he goes, nope. It's weird. It's not weird. It's fucked up, kind of, in a way.
Yeah, I believe that it's a responsibility, and it shouldn't be something that's hard. It's not a hardship for us to engage in learning about new things. But I think a lot of people, or some people in the world, are set in their ways and they don't want to restructure how they've learned about the world. For example, I remember talking to a friend who was taught that, unfortunately, when he was in school, I mean, he was born in the later 60s, early 70s, but when he was in school, he's a black man. His teachers told him that some slaves wanted to be slaves. And that's a problem. And right. I think it does come down a lot to resources and education and who's writing the textbooks. If you look and see about who's writing the history textbooks or who has written a lot of those textbooks, from the ones that I've learned from, you learn from a lot of those people are white men and straight white men.
Sorry. All right. At least I'm gay. I have that going for me.
Yeah. And I mean, I do think it's kind of up to us to present and help people find the resources to relearn. We're relearning. We're restructuring and relearning, and we have to do that. And because it's been too long, and it comes back in the form of murder. It comes back in the form of disenfranchisement. It comes back in the form of not having the resources, not having good education, not having living resources, not having access to the vaccine, not having access to a healthy birth. Like, talk to black women about how afraid they are to give birth because many doctors won't believe them when they say they're having like excruciating pain, and then some of them die. Like, I mean, there is a serious problem with multiple aspects of our world. And I think it comes down to educating oneself and learning and trying harder, you know? And I think that's, kind of up to us to do that and share with our friends and have these conversations and be like, okay, well, you don't know about the Black women in the music scene, or if we're talking about jazz or whatever, you know, you share like, hey, for example, there's a wonderful bass player who's a friend of mine, India Owens, who's doing this incredible initiative called the Community Cookout. And she's bringing together people in all of these different communities around New York and Brooklyn, and she's playing music for free. And then she's offering meals for the community members to come. And there's all these people who come by and children who come by, and it's beautiful, you know? And so there's work that's being done already behind the scenes, and people need to pay attention, you know, and need to give some credit, because, you know, in terms of intersectionality and gender equity, I think we owe maybe 100% to Black women, to the Black feminists, you know?
Right. Yeah. It's kind of, I don't remember who I was speaking with. Maybe it was Erica von Kleist. I don't know if you saw that interview, but when we're having these conversations, speaking about energy and being an empath, and also be saying, instead of saying, I no longer have brain cancer, I'm saying, I am now healed. Why is it important that we talk about sexism or racism or homophobia or any of these subjects? Are we not just giving it more attention and more energy? So what's our solution? And I was hoping you would just react to even just that. I'm because there's part of me, because pretty much all of my guests, we've had conversations about one or all of those subjects. But at the same time, you know, that project, what's it called? The cookout? What's it called? Sorry.
The Community Cookout.
Right.
That's the name.
That sounds like a very positive, affirming action. Like, instead of, you know, bitching and moaning on social media about it or whatever they're doing, you know, she's out there doing these cookouts and presenting these artists or whatever process is going on. Does this sound fair to you, or am I totally being a white male over here? I don't know.
No, I mean, for sure. I think there has to be a healthy balance of all of that. And I don't know if you follow like people like Brittany Cooper, who she wrote this book called, I believe it's called Eloquent Rage or something like that. And if you read the original Combahee River Collective statement, which was written by a coalition of Black lesbians in the 70s, I believe that anger is a part of it. And I think anger and rage is a part of the work, you know, being angry about the situation.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Let me ask you that question as someone who's not straight, as a non-heterosexual person, have you felt anger in your situation before?
Yes.
Yeah. And I think, I feel that is such a huge part of the work and how we change the system. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was more, my anger was more about the process of coming out of the closet and being called faggot over and over by my friends as a kid, right?
Yeah.
And once you kick that door open and come out, it's your friends, it gets less and less, you know, where they use derogatory terms like faggot and things like that and think they're being funny, like, oh, you're just a faggot, ha ha ha, like, yeah, kind of, but I never said I'm gonna kick cancer's ass, I never said fuck cancer, right? Maybe I did once, but that wasn't my take on it. I wasn't in a battle with cancer. I learned to understand why, what it was trying to teach me, and I went to try to understand what it was teaching me, and so I could move on and heal. And so I know that it's important that we rise up. I'm going to be at a march for Medicare for All in July, and that's very important, but I'm not going there with anger. I'm going to play a show. I'm going to march with them. I'm like, Medicare for All, yay, beautiful. This is, you know, would be wonderful if this could happen, you know? Oh, and they just passed the Obamacare again, right? Didn't that just happen like a couple of days ago?
Yeah, I need to check in. I've been in a different world.
But what but world
I need
is
to check in.
What world have you been in? Please let us in.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I think just I've been on this tip of I have a book club with a couple friends, and we've been talking a lot about, you know, these issues that we're talking about here, including anger and how to deal with it in order to create change and to create a movement and creating sort of community aspects of caring for these issues that, you know, we need to organize, Ben, and end of story, you know, because if we sort of coalesce all these people who care about the same issues, then we have power, and power really is, you know, kind of the way that we get things done in our world, unfortunately.
Right.
And if you don't have power, and how is power given people, and how do people get power? And
yeah, how is the power
world because
how is the power delineated is the real question.
Yes.
Because after the January 6th insurrection and blah, 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 and all this stuff, it's obvious that white males have a lot of fucking power and influence, at least in the US, if not around the entire world, right? And who gave them that power? Mm-hmm. And did they just take it? I mean, I'm sure everybody knows the answer to those questions, but it's just like, damn.
They just took it.
They just took it.
They just took it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's disheartening to watch. And it's tough for somebody like me who is a white male, although I'm a gay man and have been, you know, since I was a teenager, but it sometimes it doesn't count unless you say it out loud. And, you know, at one point, I was like, what am I supposed to wear a gay flag everywhere I go so people know? Because I tend to act on the straighter side of the gay world, right? I'm not really a femme, I'm more of a butch. But so it's just one of those things where, you know, I've been lobbed into the white male category and I'm like, right, okay. Yeah, I do have privilege. I do understand that, but I'm doing my best to engage like this, to engage with Caroline, to engage with, you know, Aries, and to engage with Carlo, and to engage with these people who are, you know, on the other side. And I don't know how that happens. I don't know how white men were able to create two sides. It confuses the shit out of me, which is why I'm not reading books right now. I'm watching the fucking news. I'm following all this shit. I'm watching Joe Biden give the speech about Juneteenth. And I'm like, this is like dad saying, and tomorrow we all get to have ice cream. And every Monday we're going to have ice cream. Is everybody happy about that? You know what I mean? It's like, really? And I'm not dissing Juneteenth, but like, where's my fucking healthcare? When I had brain cancer, where's my healthcare? I didn't have insurance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And now all of a sudden this vaccine, I'm not an anti-vaxxer, but all of a sudden they're giving us this vaccine, no problem, free of charge, no problem, you know, or the corona test, right? No problem. But when I had fucking terminal brain cancer, what was that? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and it honestly, it makes people who have the terminal illnesses, I feel that it makes those people feel that it's their fault.
Yeah.
It's not your fault.
Yeah,
it's
yeah. Not, there's this know? One woman who had, I don't remember, I think she had breast cancer or something. And so I was a part of this forum back in the day before social media. And she said, yeah, not only do I not have health care, not only do I have cancer, but I have to go in for treatments once a week. And they charge me $20 for parking.
just a little stick there.
I'm only laughing because it's so ridiculous that it's like, I'm very happy Juneteenth is a holiday. Please don't get mad at me, folks. That's Caroline and I were just talking off air about how it feels like this weird kind of like, look over here. Don't worry about healthcare. Don't worry about healthcare. Don't worry about your income. Don't worry about the fact that we're going to rip your unemployment away from you, or, you know, your stipend or whatever people are getting. and the jobs are shit and they don't pay anything. And we didn't put the minimum wage in there. You don't have, you know, all this stuff. Right.
And we're also like, don't worry about how Juneteenth hasn't been in any textbook that we've been learning about.
I only learned
Columbus
about,
Day.
Right. Yeah. Columbus Day
isn't, it's in there.
I mean, I only heard about Juneteenth from social media. I hadn't, well, coming up, they never talked about that.
Yeah, I learned about it in school, fortunately, but I was given, I had a good teacher, right, for history in that part of my life. And so it was honest, and they were using knowledge that they had learned outside of the textbooks. Is this not really in the textbooks? And so that's what I feel is an issue. It's like the mandating of education and resource and the availability of this information to people is what we should be concerned about. And I'm really glad that Juneteenth is a holiday. Don't get me wrong, but there's a bunch of other stuff that needs to be implemented, you know?
Right. I agree. And as an example, I was watching this interview with Bryan Cranston, and he was, I think it was a friend of his in Australia. Australia. Who said, do teachers really have to have second jobs in America? Right? Because he worked at a car wash, right? And Brian was like, yeah. And sometimes they have three jobs. And this Australian woman was just like, I think it was a friend of his, was like, no way. And he's like, yeah, that's like a thing. That is not fiction. Teachers have to have second jobs. Some of them have three jobs to stay afloat. There's something not right here.
Yeah.
Not black, white, straight, gay, male, female, none of that stuff. I'm just saying there are other things that we could be focusing on that, you know, your son or daughter, not yours, but somebody's son or daughter has, you know, teacher, history teacher has to like drive a bus or whatever, work at a car wash or whatever they do as well. It's so weird, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's our children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's also a system that's been implemented, and there are ways to get around that. And our government, who is run by rich white males, aren't.
True, there it is.
I mean, they're not doing anything to restructure the equity.
And if anything, they're fighting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Your teachers are like, you know, maybe saying, hey, we want a living wage. And no, we're not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I don't have any proof of that. I'm not that deeply steeped into politics that I can actually talk intelligently about that. But it's like, yeah, I don't think you really give a fuck about the teachers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Not you. I'm talking about the hypothetical politician I'm talking about.
Oh, I see.
not you. That wasn't about you. Mm-hmm. I was talking about this hypothetical politician. Why didn't you pass a fucking $15 minimum wage, when it really actually with inflation should be, I think that it's $53 an hour or $52 an hour. Like if you really compensated for inflation,
mm-hmm.
What? Did you lose me?
No, I'm here. Oh, maybe I did lose you. Wait, I think I did lose you. Cause now I'm like, wait, what happened?
I was just to reiterate, I was talking about the unemployment, about the minimum wage and how they won't pass even $15 an hour. I mean, what is that a week?
That's not enough. Not enough.
My friends just got a new place in New York, and it's $4,200 a month. I mean, you can't live off $15 an hour.
No. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I recently saw a post on social media from like a driver, an Uber driver, you know, or actually it was an Uber Eats delivery person, you know, and they were talking about their tip that they got. It was really just a video of this person crying, and they were in their car and tears were streaming down their face, and they were saying how they drove for I think an hour or a little over an hour to drop off one person, and they got a dollar tip
Then
$2 from the company, and that's $3. And then they were doing all the math about how much their apartment is and how if they didn't get paid more they'll be on the street, you know.
I the other day I get my medication, my seizure medication, from this company called Capsule. and they deliver. Yeah. That's their whole thing. And the guy comes, he brings me my prescription, and it's all set up with the app and all that stuff. And I gave the guy $10 and he looked at me like, thank you. And so my friend Nicole, who's the one who recommended that I use Capsule, especially during the pandemic, she goes, I don't think people tip them. And I said, I don't think so. This guy was so surprised. And I gave him $10 because I feel guilty. Like, dude probably drove, what, 20, 30 minutes to get to my house. And it was a dude. It was a man. And, you know, I was like, you know, I'm sorry I can't do more, but, you know, here's $10. And he just looked at me like, thanks. Like, you know, just. And I'm thinking, how many delivers does he do a day? And how many people are, like you said, are tipping a dollar or nothing? It's really, it's depressing.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think there are little things that we can do in our community and in the structure of our communities to bring attention to those issues.
Like what, Caroline? Go ahead. Let's finish off the show with your, and I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just trying to be real. But yeah. So Caroline Davis, thank you for being on the show. And she's going to give us all some stuff we can do within the community to help this Uber driver and this Capsule driver and anybody else who's suffering. Or not suffering, but, you know, is making $3, you know, a day.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I have all of the answers.
No, of course, none of us do.
I'm certainly not the social justice warrior that other people I look up to are. Like, I think there are people in my immediate community who are doing a lot for one of the aspects and issues I really care deeply about it is gender. So one of the people I think is sort of championing that work is a good colleague of mine, friend, whose name is Sarah Charles, Sarah Elizabeth Charles. And she's doing a lot, not only in the community with people by having conversations with them about gender and equity in jazz and Black American music, but also creating programs. She created this program at the New School, and we teach this course together called Jazz and Gender, where we sort of redraw the whole history of the music in terms of the players and personalities that were left out of the history book of jazz and Black American music. And those are the heroes for me. Other people like Terry Lynn Carrington and Asia Burrell Wood, who are doing that same work at Berklee, by creating a new real book with compositions by female and non-binary composers. That's incredible work.
That's very cool.
We don't have that, you know?
Yeah.
And we have real books with mostly white male composers. And thank God there are a lot of, you know, great Black composers in the music that we can celebrate, but we also need to be more specific about putting the other underrepresented folks in there and creating a book of music and expanding the books that we have to include those voices. So those are a couple things, you know.
Yeah, very cool. Again, thank you, Caroline, for coming on today, and congratulations with your engagement. And where are you getting married? Where's the wedding happening?
On the beach. It's going to be a pop-up wedding. So very chill and no stress. So, but
yeah. No, like traveling to see family or any of that stuff or any of the stresses that come with the.
No.
Right? All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. Maybe you can come back on and we can explore these subjects a little more, and have a beautiful evening, and I'll talk to you later.
Thanks.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Constant Constance. Tune in every week for new conversations. And if you want even more, check out Andrew's Patreon for more exclusive content and additional conversations. Hosted and produced by Andrew D'Angelo. Edited and mixed by Lucy Little. Original music by Andrew D'Angelo and Maximilian Moore D'Angelo. Intro is Henrietta Weeks. Thanks so much. See you next time.
You fucking beautiful. Yeah, you fucking rocked it. Like, she doesn't know she says podcast, right? Like, she doesn't even